I'm Christopher Lydon with the Pakistani physicist, filmmaker, and public citizen Pervez Hoodboy. We're asking him about the roots of what looks like the international emergency. We'll ask him about remedies, too. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. Pervez Hoodboy, so happy to be with you. It dawns slowly among people who worry about the world disappearing in a fireball of religious extremism that the urgent problem is not Stone Age Afghanistan, maybe not even half-modern Iran, but rather the nuclear-tipped Islamic State of Pakistan. You've been engaged with these issues for 30 years and some. Where do we begin?
You're absolutely right that today religious extremism is becoming probably among the world's most important problems, competing with climate change, competing with nuclear weapons, and in fact contributing to the spread of nuclear weapons. But let's go back to the middle of the 20th century when you couldn't find a single fundamentalist leader among any of the Muslim countries. Jamal Abdel Nasser was an Egyptian socialist. Ahmad Sukarno was a communist. Mm. You had Mohammad Mossadegh, who was a nationalist who wanted to safeguard Iran's oil and didn't want Standard Oil to take over instead. You had the PLO, which was a secular force in the Middle East. It had Christians amongst it. It even had a few token Jews. But if you look today, the political scene is completely different. Now the Palestinians are, well, principally with Hamas, which is a fundamentalist, I'd say fanatical organization. Today in Pakistan, you have no longer the kind of liberal open society that you had in the 1960s. Instead, you have one that's increasingly dominated by mullahs, by fanatics, essentially. So the question is, how did this come about? And I'd be glad to discuss this.
You tell me. It was once upon a time the Ataturk model of, in Turkey, as you say, a kind of secular nationalism, pan-Arabism at some times. But what was the turn?
Look at Iran. Mossadegh, a nationalist, was overthrown by the CIA. In his place comes the Shah of Iran, who subsequently is overthrown, and then comes Khomeini. So Khomeini is a direct response to a secular nationalist government being overthrown by the United States. In the Middle East, you see that because the PLO has been essentially decimated by the Israelis, well, there's no hope for the Palestinians, and so they start taking refuge in religious nationalism. If you take Pakistan, now that's where I think the biggest problem today is in the world. And I'll tell you how that came about. It was 1979 when the Soviets invaded Afghanistan. And then the United States, Pakistan, and Saudi Arabia got together and they created this international jihad. And so you had the CIA bring in the strongest and the most ideologically charged of fighters from across the globe. You had the CIA actually placing advertisements in magazines like Soldier of Fortune. And so it was billions and billions of dollars that were pumped into the creation of the Mujahideen. They were celebrated by Ronald Reagan. You had guys like Charlie Wilson, who even have written books. And it was the University of Nebraska, which was given $50 million by USAID to create these books which had absolutely vile propaganda against the Soviets, that they were infidels. Then you had the CIA distributing millions of Qurans in madrasas in Pakistan and Afghanistan, etc., etc. So then it was this monster which eventually grew so big that it was completely out of control. It ate up its masters, the United States and now Pakistan.
Not the least of it, though, is that the United States is still believing its own propaganda and denying its own responsibility.
Yes, that is unfortunately true, although you have had now people like Hillary Clinton actually apologize for that period. But it's too late. Now the genie is out of the bottle. And so both Pakistan and the United States bear responsibility for having created this monster. Osama bin Laden was, and al-Zawahiri and all these people who are terrorists and who are being sought after so eagerly by the United States, well, these were creations of the CIA. And that's why people in Pakistan are so angry. However, I should say not all of this anger is justified, because it was really a desire of the Pakistani establishment to use the Mujahideen after the Soviet Union had disintegrated, use these guys to, quote, liberate Kashmir for us Pakistanis, and to create strategic depth in Afghanistan. In other words, to make Afghanistan Pakistan's backyard. So our secret intelligence agencies, our army establishment was fully engaged in using covert warfare against India. Eventually that got out of control. And so today what we have in Pakistan is a bloody civil war between the mentors and creators of the fanatics and the army itself.
Explain what you mean by a civil war.
Within the army establishment itself, there are elements which have plotted and connived against their own colleagues. So let me give you examples. The ISI, the Inter-Services Intelligence, which is perhaps the most powerful organization in any country as far as secret services goes, has been infiltrated to the point where three of its headquarters have been blown up by suicide bombers. Now, these suicide bombers couldn't possibly have had access to these headquarters unless there had been insiders. Similarly, the heart of the Pakistani army establishment, the general headquarters in Rawalpindi, was attacked. And again, it was an insider job. So what we have now is that you could call them rogue elements, but it's more than rogue, because there's an enormous tension that is tearing apart Pakistani society. On the one hand, there are the elements of civil society, of just ordinary people. And on the other, there is the part of society which has been deeply influenced by Islamist propaganda and Islamist thought. This goes back to the time of General Ziaul Haq, who took power in 1977 and then was propped up by the Americans after 1979 for a period of 9 years after that, because he was America's ally during the Cold War and helped to bring the Soviet Union down. Now, Ziaul Haq had an agenda for Pakistan. What he wanted to do was to change it from being a Muslim state into becoming an Islamic state. Now, a Muslim state is, a state where the majority of people who live are Muslims. But an Islamic state is one that's run by Sharia, Islamic law. And so he had the school curriculum changed. He had the notion of Pakistan redone. He had all the subjects Islamicized. He made, if you wanted to become a physics professor at that time, you would have to be able to recite certain passages, difficult passages of the Quran. You would have to know, for example, the names of the wives of the Prophet, 11 in number. You would have to jump over hurdles like that. So the whole texture of society was changed by this dictator.
Hillary Clinton's apology for the U.S. hand in this history kind of slipped under my radar. I'm much more aware of her presenting a monstrous check to the Pakistani government, mostly for the army, it seems. What would it take to undo the American influence in Pakistan's problem, our problem?
Yes, it is true that Hillary Clinton apologized, in a manner of speaking, a few months ago. But, as you said, it slipped under your radar, and it slipped under the radar of most Americans. The problem is that the mess that we're seeing in Pakistan today was, in part, America's responsibility. Now the issue is that can you compensate for this by simply pumping in a whole amount of money, billions or tens of billions or whatever? And the answer is no, because the wound, for one thing, needs time to heal, but for another, I don't think that money is the salve which will fix it. Because there is a feeling in Pakistan, and a widespread feeling, that the U.S. has an instrumentalist view in looking at Pakistan. It uses it when it is in America's interest and then dumps it when it's not. There's some truth in that. There has not been sincerity or goodwill in America's commitment to Pakistan, and that kind of resentment now is deep within people's hearts, which is why I'd say that Pakistan is the most anti-American country in the world. And that's really dangerous. Yeah.
Rank the outstanding complaints against Uncle Sam from the use of Pakistan as a kind of geopolitical footstool. It's a way to beat the Russians. It's Henry Kissinger's route into China. It's a place of convenience. Down to, I want to hear about the drones too. I mean, what's the list of complaints?
Pakistan has a long litany of complaints, and I think some are justified and others are not. The justifiable ones we've just talked about, it's that Pakistan was used by the United States in Afghanistan. The entire jihad movement was built up. Once the Soviet Union crashed, the U.S. walked away. Then it goes further than that. You have these drone attacks. You have the Americans trying to steal our nuclear weapons. And that's really got into people's psychology. Now, coming back to why the U.S. is so disliked in Pakistan, I'd say these are some of the reasons, but there's a deeper reason. It's because we in Pakistan need somebody to blame for our own failures. We have to point the finger somewhere else. The fact is that we have not educated our people, given them the basics of life, jobs. Instead, Pakistan has been ruled by an oligarchy, by an establishment that is fixated upon India. So we've spent the bulk of our resources trying to fight India, as a consequence of which we've impoverished our people. So you need to point your finger at someone, and what's better than America? Because there's already reason to blame it for.
Hmm. You've written about the retreat of Sufism, the retreat of traditional Pakistani culture, even of the sort of founding Pakistani nationalism. Are these trends part of what we should be worrying about?
I'm tremendously worried about how Pakistani culture is being morphed into something that looks suspiciously like Saudi culture. You see it at very different levels. We used to be taught about the world. We used to be taught about history, geography. Religion wasn't thrust into everything. Now it is. Everything is regarded through the prism of religion and a particular variant of the religion. And that's the Saudi Wahhabi way of looking at things. It's infiltrated our language. We used to say while parting, Khuda Hafiz, that is, God be with you. Now we say, Allah Hafiz. Now there's a subtle difference over here. The Persian god, Khuda, has been replaced by the Arabic god, Allah. Mm. People have started dressing differently. There are now burqas everywhere. So when I teach my class in the university, physics classes, I cannot see half the faces of my women students. And it's totally different from what it used to be when I first started teaching in the university 37 years ago. It's an enormous cultural transformation, and it's driven by the literalism, by the fundamentalism that has so permeated our society now.
Mm. You have seen this face of Islamism that most Americans haven't. What does it look like, and why is it so powerful, so threatening, the United States feels, to us, but even to you?
I'm threatened because Islamism threatens to drag us back into the 7th century with its penal code, with its insistence that the laws have been written down in the Quran and that they're immutable and that you as a human being, as a man or woman, cannot change that which is in the book. And so what we are now increasingly faced with is the primitivization of society. I am very afraid of what this might mean for the future of Pakistan. Mm. Now, if one looks at the tribal areas, there it's now become almost an inviolable social code that you have to have a beard. You cannot wear trousers but must wear shalwar. The Taliban, where they're in control, they say that you cannot watch television. And in fact, television is considered to be the source of sin. After the 2005 earthquake, which happened in many areas of Pakistan, well, there was the mullahs who came out and said, this happened because you were watching television. And so there were thousands of televisions which were broken. And the interesting thing is that Pakistani scientists, those guys who publish in research journals, hardly any one of them dared to contest this. Mm. And so, in fact, after I returned from those areas and I went to my class, I was teaching atomic physics at that time, or statistical mechanics, two classes actually. I returned and I said to my students, I said, you know, I've been over there, seen this terrible devastation, and we have two duties. One is as Pakistani citizens to help our brethren. The other is that as students of science, we got to tell these people that it wasn't the wrath of God. It wasn't that people were sinful that the earthquake happened. It happened because tectonic plates were moving on a fluid surface of the earth, and this is how mountains grow and subduction happens, etc. And there was outrage in the class. Mm. Against me. They said, but professor, don't you know that it is written in the Quran that this is how God punishes doers of bad? And then we had an argument on that, and I went to the next class and I got exactly the same response. A few students later on came to me and said, professor, we're really sorry. We thought you were right, but we couldn't speak up.
Hmm. And what do you sense about the seriousness of a confrontation with the West? The West where you got a high polish on your education, the West that you know very well. What is the real attitude toward us?
Now, here is, I think, a very difficult situation. On the one hand, speaking for myself, I see the United States as being an open society, as one that is relatively equalitarian compared to other countries in the world. It's one that values excellence and talent. On the other hand, when it is dealing with other countries at the level of the state, then it seems to put its perceived national priorities above human rights, above the rule of law, as we saw in the case of Iraq. So the U.S. is very good when you're within the U.S. itself, but it's pretty mean to people outside at times.
Coming back to the faces behind the burqas, the face of Islam in Pakistan, what's the chance of denting this movement?
I would not like to see a revolution in Pakistan today, because the only revolution that can come is that of an Islamist variety. The reason is that we have not prepared our people for a true revolution which would be liberating both for women and for men, which would allow freedom of thought, which would make us like other progressive countries in the world. And so the only thing that our people have got in their schools, in the mosques, from the media, is something that is properly of the 7th century. So the golden age of Islam is put before them as the thing to aspire to. Mm. It's not the modern progressive socialist ideal. I'd say that we are at a particularly low period in terms of where Muslims are going and in terms of the relationship of Muslims with the West in general. there are different things that need to be done on the Muslim side and on the Western side. On the Muslim side, I think that it's time to stop blaming everything onto the West and to get out of this paranoid mindset that, oh, it's all some gigantic conspiracy against Muslims everywhere, that we are being held back by the Christians, by the Jews and whatever, and so essentially blaming all our problems over onto the West. That's false, because Muslims haven't produced anything in science for the last 700-800 years. Yeah, they did a lot for 400 years earlier to that. But where's a Muslim scientist to be found who's done something great? Where's the great architecture or the intellectual progress in any field, whether it be astronomy, medicine, or physics, mathematics, whatever? It's you have within the orthodoxy those who say that music is haram. And so how is science to flourish? How are the arts to flourish when you have this kind of orthodoxy that's gripped people's minds and imposed itself upon them? But now coming to what the U.S. and the West in general needs to do. Well, for one thing, it needs to stop trying to run the world. And it needs to stop invading countries. Iraq was one example. But now when I think of the move or the sentiment within the U.S. to bomb Iran because it's acquiring nukes, it frightens me, because this will be Iraq multiplied by 10. For heaven's sakes, don't do it. I don't want Iran to acquire nukes. However, to bomb Iran and to try and stop it in this way from acquiring nukes will be an absolute, total, unmitigated disaster. So don't even think about it. And whether it's Israel which does it or whether it's the United States which does it, doesn't matter. This is going to cause a fracture which I don't think can be healed, not for another century.
Parenthetically, you speak of the openness in the United States, which we cherish. I'm staggered by the openness in Pakistani society, where people like you can write and all sorts of people can say very dissident kinds of things and come in and out freely. How do we come to understand that in a kind of religious dictatorship, all sorts of people are saying all kinds of things, nasty things about the government?
Oh, you shouldn't be fooled by what I'm saying over here. The fact is that lots of people get killed in Pakistan. Yes, I say these things there, and I say them openly in Urdu, on television, whenever I get the chance. I speak out against the Taliban. I speak out against extremism. But let me also tell you that this is not without risk. In this last 1 year, 3 vice chancellors of Pakistani universities have been kidnapped. 2 of them have been killed. And it has been the religious extremists behind it, or it's been ethnic violence, both. So the fact that there might be a few inconsequential voices like mine ought not to make you change your mind that we are a society under threat. Of course, there are paradoxes within it. I think the Pakistani media is probably the most critical of the government anywhere. But that's because the Pakistani state is so weak and it is so fractured from within, so that there are competing forces within that establishment which assure that that competing voices will not be attacked.
Worries about Pakistan are categorically different just because it has nukes already. Practically, what's the danger?
There are 2 dangers associated with Pakistani nuclear weapons. First, there could be some kind of a confrontation with India which escalates to the point where a conventional war starts and nuclear weapons are used either deliberately or accidentally in the crisis which would ensue. And secondly, there is a small but non-zero probability that these nukes could somehow be stolen, or material that is fissionable could be stolen. I think that both of these dangers exist, particularly the danger with India, because we've had 4 nuclear confrontations so far. And of course, they didn't evolve into a nuclear war. But I also think that with India and Pakistan both pressing down on the pedal and trying to make as many nukes as possible, that we'll have so many, and with their control so diversified, that something could go wrong sometime. Then, as far as the safety and security of Pakistan's nuclear arsenal is concerned, I think that, although all possible precautions have been taken in technical terms, or at least so we are told, that these precautions, like fitting in electronic locks or permissive action links and so forth, may not be enough. The reason is that the Pakistani intelligence and the army establishment is infiltrated from within by these rogue Islamist elements. And one doesn't know whether there'll be collusion between these elements and, let's say, a group thinking similarly outside. And if that happens, that could be catastrophic, because it's not so much of a complete nuclear weapon being stolen that I'm afraid of. It's that you could have highly enriched uranium cores, which are taken out from these weapons and then made into a simpler weapon. And the simpler weapon won't be that efficient in terms of the yield, but it could be catastrophic. I also think that it is principally Pakistan and India which have to fear these jihadists even more than the United States or Europe. Because let's remember that the jihadists are willing to blow themselves up in mosques and bazaars in Pakistan, and they would love to have a bomb that they could blow up in Islamabad or maybe even Delhi.
What does the world have to do? What does Pakistan have to do to defuse the dangers here? And I'm thinking of secular government, perhaps. Science, perhaps. Is this a remedy? Is liberation of popular culture a real remedy? What has to happen here?
Well, we Pakistanis have got to get over this notion that we need to fix everything in the world. Yes. So the first issue is that of Kashmir. India has, I believe, wrongly held Kashmir against the wishes of a part of its people. Well, it's bad. But why do we in Pakistan have to change this situation militarily? We've tried to do it three times, gone to war three times with India, and each time we've been defeated. Now, we need to get out of this and start concentrating on the welfare of our own people, educate them, provide them jobs. And it's only then that we can have a country which is happy. Only a happy country can prosper. We have a major problem in terms of how the different peoples in Pakistan live together. They can't stand each other now. The Baloch are up in arms against the central government in Punjab. A Punjabi who goes to Balochistan stands at the risk of being killed. It's so bad that the Pakistani flag is not flown in Balochistan. They don't sing the national anthem. So we got to fix those problems for ourselves and stop worrying about India making nukes. Stop trying to compete with India on everything. In doing so, we have really destroyed ourselves. Now we could move to a different scale and ask, what should Muslims be doing, and how is it that they can dig themselves out of the hole that they're in now? And I say, the most important thing is to loosen up. Let your societies become free. Because only in freedom do you have people realizing their potential, of their genuinely educating themselves, of becoming competitive in today's world, which is dominated by science and technology, of liberating their artistic and creative abilities. We cannot live under 7th century laws. And we have to now move on. For the West, I say, it's important, A, not to invade countries, B, to solve the Israeli-Palestinian issue. Because a reasonable solution of the Palestinian-Israeli issue would then open up the doors to reconciliation And I think it could lead to a transformed world. Because in itself, this issue is not important. I say in itself because how many Palestinians and how many Jews are there? It's less than 20 million, perhaps, all of them included. How many Palestinians plus Jews have been killed? I'd say less than, 40, 50,000 in all.
Tops.
On the other hand, if you look to see how many have been killed in Darfur, how many have been killed in Kashmir, it's much, much more than that. However, the significance of the Palestinian issue is that here were a people who were living on a land and they were forcibly displaced by another religious community who asserted their claim to that land on religious grounds. And so it became a religious issue. Now, for that reason, it has enormous significance. And I think if we are to decrease the role of religion in the world and its ability to promote conflict, then we've got to somehow solve this issue.
Of course, the Israeli-Palestinian question is the world's favorite distraction from doing something at home, too. In the ongoing American war in Afghanistan, David Petraeus says it could go on for his lifetime and his children's lifetime. What's the better way?
The Afghan situation is a complex one, and I don't have ready answers. On the one hand, I do not want the Americans there because their presence fuels resistance. And there's no doubt about the fact that if the Americans had not been there, we wouldn't have had the Taliban. On the other hand, I am worried about an instantaneous U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan. Were it to leave tomorrow at 9 o'clock in the morning, you can guess what will happen. The Taliban will be back in Kabul. There will be bodies swaying from lampposts. Women will be confined to their homes, whipped in public. There'll be a bloodbath, just as we saw in 1996. So yes, I do want the United States to go, but I don't want it to go leaving the people there unprotected. In other words, the U.S. is morally obligated to clean up the mess before it exits. Now, exactly what does that mean? That's where I am not too clear. I know that it cannot leave next month or in the next few months, because if it does, then the people are unprotected. So some mechanism has to be worked out so that people are not slaughtered. And it's true that there is negotiation now going on with the Taliban, but the Taliban now are sensing total victory. And what that means is that these guys could come back. And that, to me, is a bigger nightmare than that of the Americans staying over there.
You're ranking our nightmares for us, at least. Pervez Hoodboy, it's such a pleasure to hear it straight from a very brave citizen. And I hope we'll continue the conversation here or there. But thank you enormously.
Well, thank you.
Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over until you feed back on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for being part of the conversation.